Can we take some of the lessons we're learning here in this structured team environment, and can we apply those lessons to our everyday work?
I'd like to welcome John Zaratsky to the Productivities Podcast. John, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm holding in my hands Make Time, How to Focus on What Matters Every Day. And I need to ask out of the gate, because you wrote this with Jake Knapp, and you guys have this. I want to talk about time dorks first, right?
Sure.
And what led, number one, to the formation of this partnership? Because this is not the first book you've written together, number one, right?
Correct, yeah.
And number two, that partnership is continuing, right? Like, you mean this is something that you guys are passionate about, so much so that you call yourself dorks about it. So what what led to the formation of this partnership, and why the fascination with time?
Yeah. Well, Jake and I both individually became kind of obsessed with productivity, you know, in sort of the you know, what I think of as the golden era of early 2000s productivity optimization, with getting things done and Merlin Mann writing 43 folders and the proliferation of all sorts of slick new to-do list apps and project management tools. And we were both individually working at some tech companies, and we ended up both working at Google. But for my part, you know, I was sort of just motivated by a general sense, a general, you know, desire to be good at my job. I remember when I graduated from college and started my first job, and there was, of course, all the things I needed to figure out how to do in my work. And I was a designer at a tech startup. But then there was also this new challenge of, like, how do I manage my time? You know, I'm not in school anymore. I'm not, you know, I don't have professors setting deadlines and assigning homework and taking me through a 5-part structure of how to write a paper. Instead, I've got bosses who are like, hey, we hired you to, like, design this website, so go do it. And so I had to figure out not just the technical domain specific stuff, but I had to figure out how to manage my time. And so, you know, in wanting to just make the most of that opportunity, I got really into optimizing and tweaking my productivity and my efficiency. And the company I was working for, we were acquired by Google after a couple of years. And so this was in 2007. I found myself working at Google, and I was still a designer, but I kind of had this out of body experience where I was looking at myself from the outside and seeing my time go more and more toward meetings and email and bureaucracy and stuff like that, instead of the, you know, the work of being a designer, you know, the work of of creating new products and services and things like that. And so I tried to kind of optimize my way out of that, but I found that the faster I ran, the faster the treadmill moved, or the faster the hamster wheel spun, or, you know, choose your metaphor of choice. But I realized that I had just gotten really, really good at reacting to what other people were asking of me, requesting of me, and that I didn't always have time for the work that was kind of at the core of my job and of why I did what I did, not to mention the things that I wanted to be spending time on outside of work. And so I didn't really have a great solution for this until a few years later, when Jake and I met. We both worked at Google Ventures. And we were in this position there where the firm would invest in a startup. So Google Ventures is a venture capital firm funded by Google. So we would invest in a startup, and then Jake and I would go inside that company and work with them like consultants. And we realized that we had this very unique opportunity, this almost laboratory, to jump from company to company, team to team, and think about how they spend their time. You know, suddenly it wasn't just about us and the work that we wanted to get done. It was about trying to empower and help all these other people spend their time in smart and effective ways. And as a result of that experience, we came up with something called the design sprint process. And that's what we ended up writing our first book about. But we were so, you know, inspired and excited by the work that we were doing with all those companies and these design sprint processes and watching it spread to companies around the world, that we kind of started to wonder, hey, could we Could we take some of the lessons we're learning here in this structured team environment, and can we apply those lessons to our everyday work? You know, could we apply this to the stuff that happens in between those design sprints, the sort of everyday, you know, the day in, day out, I'm just in the office doing my thing, doing what I've got to do. Could there be kind of a system or a framework for that that was less about efficiency and productivity and just sort of a pure like output sense, and more about really focusing and really structuring time around the things that truly mattered? And so that is where Time Dorks came from, and that's where Make Time ultimately came from.
So I was in that forefront of the productivity movement. You mentioned Merlin Mann, of course, Merlin 43 Folders. I'll link it in the show notes. Most people consider him to be the internet godfather of modern productivity.
Yep.
And then we saw the advent of productivity porn, for lack of a better term, right? Like so much stuff out there telling how to be more productive. And what I like about this, about Make Time, is that number one, I think, and I'll circle back to this in a minute, but there's a framework involved, which we'll discuss as we go through our conversation. But you've distilled it down, knowing full well that, as through your own journey, I would imagine, that you can't do it all at once. Like, you've got bite-sized chunks of like, here's a tactic, here's something you can try. How important was it for you when you were putting this book together to say, okay, we need to make this doable so that people could see the incremental ability to make time, as opposed to this wholesale, and we'll circle back to like the productivity movement, where like getting things done would be a massive undertaking for a lot of people. Whereas this, like, as I was going through the book, as someone who studied productivity for, you know, the past decade, I'm like, this is something someone could pick it up and do it today. How important was that to you, putting this book together?
I don't remember a version of the book that wasn't like that. You know, that was essential from the very beginning of when Jake and I started talking about it. And that came from that desire to make it sort of bite-sized and customizable. That came from two different perspectives that we had. One was our perspective as time dorks, as productivity nerds who had read tons of books and tons of blogs and tried tons of systems, and this realization that one size fits all systems tend to be brittle, in the sense that you know there's this big buildup to getting everything set up and making it perfect, and then there's kind of this fear that if you fall off the wagon, you know, if it falls apart, then suddenly it's not working anymore, and there's this sense of you know, perfection and this worry about failure. And so we felt that, you know, one of the reasons that we had turned away from a lot of the more monolithic systems was that we just felt like that all of the stuff did not work for any of us,
right?
That we needed to find ways to adapt and to personalize and to pick and choose the parts that worked. So that was one perspective. And then the other perspective that led to this approach was that we are both designers, and we worked for many years as, you know, we still consider ourselves designers, and a lot of what we do now is designing marketing and presentations and various resources and training tools and things like that. But in those days, we were literally designing apps and websites and marketing every day. And so we had just sort of gotten used to coming at things from a customer perspective, you know, from a human perspective of like, all right, imagine I'm a person who's interested in spending their time on the things that matter. And maybe I've experimented with some of these tools and systems in the past, but found them ultimately unsustainable, or like they didn't fit my sort of view that I have about life and about how I want to spend my time. What would that person need? And so we basically designed this system, this framework, which then became the book. We designed it in a way that we felt would be really easy for somebody who was in that position to, as you said, flip through it and say, oh yeah, that's something I can do now. And then build in sort of those feedback loops of, yeah, I tried it and it helped. Like, my day was actually a little bit better. And so I'm going to pay attention to that. I'm going to take note of that, and I'm going to try to tweak it so that the next day is a little bit better than that. And then the day after that is a little bit better And, you know, just like a designer would do when they're designing a product, an app, whatever, make it really easy to get started, make the value to start very clear, but then also make sure that that value grows over time.
Which some of the monolithic systems would allow, but they're not presented that way. Like, yeah. Like getting things done, and I've had David on the show before, and I've known David for years, and the getting things done system has a ton of value. But the way that a lot of it is presented, and I'm not saying David presents it this way. I'm saying that, again, and we're going to talk about like the infinity pools and again, the productivity blogs, especially back in the day, more so. And it's still, I think there's this cult following of GTDers that they push it so hard and they offer the fine tunings that they put in place because they practiced this for a year. There's no context around that for a lot of people that are adopting it. They go, whoa, it's too big. When realistically, if you were to break it down, you could add things incrementally, like
absolutely.
You said,
yeah.
but it's, and again, I mean, when you're working with a team, like you did with when you're doing design sprints, you're working with a team, you need it to be nimble. You need to be able to have it so that someone can look at the larger view of the framework, which we'll go over, you know, the idea of, you know, highlight, laser, reflect, energize that frame, the circling back with the energizing that, people can work within that because there's a personalization component to it. It's easier to gravitate towards. Actually, that's not easier. It's simpler, I would say, because easy is if you've been used to doing things a certain way. And we talked about this before we jumped on the program about talking about some of the stuff that's going on, you know, current events we talked about, as well as, you know, this idea of myopic views and biases and things like that. I think that when you have a framework that can house these, you know, these tips, which I'm going to focus as we go through the conversation on a couple of them, because there's a lot to go through. And again, even saying it that way, like, oh, Mike, this seems like a lot. It's about making small, distinct changes, like you said, that you can build upon, because you get the confidence that, well, this worked. So I wonder if this will work.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
And
again, as design thinkers, clearly you did this by design.
Yeah. And I like how you mentioned that distinction between simple and easy. And, you know, there's a lot of things in life that are simple, but not easy. You know, you want to lose weight. Well, that's easy. You want to save for retirement. Well, that's easy too. You want to make good use of your time. That's also easy. It's simple. It's not necessarily easy. I just
right,
said it the
it's
wrong
so,
way.
But it's so, the distinction is so, most people get those confused and it's harder to, it's easier to say easy.
Yes. And one of the philosophies in Make Time is that we want people to not rely on willpower, to not say, you know what, today I'm going to be focused. Today I'm going to do the right thing. I'm going to clench my fists and I'm going to white knuckle it and I'm going to buckle down and do it. Instead, we want people to actually kind of redesign their environments. So literally change the configuration of their phones and their laptops and uninstall things and block things and reconfigure things and even move stuff around in their homes so that the decision that you want to make, the sort of the right choice in that moment, actually becomes the easy one, right? So you're giving in to easy, but you've configured stuff in a way, you've sort of outsourced your discipline, you've outsourced willpower
right.
to the environment so that when you're actually in that moment of, oh, I could grab my phone and check Twitter, or I could keep working on this thing that I know really deep down, this is what I want to be doing. You're going to go with the easy choice because, you know, Twitter isn't on your phone, or you're going to have to go through a two-factor auth to sign into Twitter, or you're going to have to grab your password out of your password manager and log in or whatever, or because your phone's not in front of you because it's put away in a cabinet somewhere. But this idea of actually making the right things the easy things, that is a really, really important philosophy that's baked into Make Time, but I think applies to a lot of other areas of life as well.
Okay, I'm going to take a break from my conversation with John now to talk about our sponsors for this episode. And I'd like to start off with talking about LinkedIn Jobs. Small businesses have unique needs, and despite the current uncertainty, one thing that remains unchanged is the importance of having the right people on your team. When your business is ready to make that next hire, LinkedIn Jobs can help by matching your role with qualified candidates so that you can find the right person quickly. And that's really important when you're trying to hire. You want to make this as painless as possible. And you want to be efficient and productive all the while. LinkedIn Jobs allows you to do that. LinkedIn is an active community of professionals with more than 690 million members worldwide. LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates with the hard and soft skills you're looking for and puts your job post in front of qualified members every day so that it's seen by people looking for jobs like yours. That's how LinkedIn Jobs can help you hire the right person faster. Now, when your business is ready to make that next hire, find the right person with LinkedIn Jobs. You can pay what you want and get the first $50 off. All you need to do is just visit linkedin.com/timecrafting. Again, that's linkedin.com/timecrafting to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. When I had Cal Newport on the show, we talked about digital minimalism, like some of the things that I've done. And I talked like the idea of I use the extensions on my phone to share things on Facebook and not go into Facebook. Like Facebook's installed, but it's buried in a folder that if I want to share a story, like for example, when I share this podcast episode, I would have used the extension on Facebook and not gone into Facebook because the first thing I see is the thing that Facebook wants me to see. Right. And it's not even what Facebook wants me to see. It's what I've told Facebook that I, that I want to see.
Yes. But Facebook has learned that you are most likely to engage with.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, I think that another example would be the rise of using your phone as an alarm clock, right? It's built in that way, but, and so there's alarms. And when that didn't work and this is no, you know, some people are like, oh, well, I don't want to use my phone alarm because I know that I'm going to pick up my phone, but then all of a sudden, like I started using Sleep Cycle, which is designed to help wake you up in a more natural way. I'm like, well, then see, this does make sense for the phone to be used. And again, I think the people who built Sleep Cycle didn't go, I know we're going to get them to keep using their phone. That wasn't the nefarious plot. It was like, hey, we can use this technology in a way that can help people wake up more naturally. And we're going to talk about the morning and night person stuff that comes up in this book as well. Let's put it this way. We won't talk about it. I'm just going to say, when you read the book, you'll have to figure out whether John is a morning person or a night person. We're not going to lean into it. Let's just say that if you've listened to this episode before, John and I are on the other side. I'm more with Jake on this. Let's put it that way. Okay. So the other thing is then it's like, okay, I use Sleep Cycle, but I don't want my phone in there because the propensity for me to grab my phone first thing in the morning is strong. Nir Eyal talks about this in Indistractable too, right?
Yeah.
And so I bought one of those Philips wake up, you know, alarm clocks that has the natural sunlight thing. Cause I'm a heavy sleeper and I'm like, that's the end of it. Like that is where, and now my phone stays out in the front room and it charges overnight. So now not only, and I think you have to reframe it too, is what do you want to get out of it? What I didn't like was I didn't like when I woke up first thing in the morning that my phone was in front of me and I saw things I didn't want to see necessarily right away because some notifications are needing to be left active. Number two, my battery life was low because I wasn't charging my phone. And number three, I wasn't getting off to the right start of my day. I didn't do my morning routine because it was being circumvented by that. So how do I fix all that? I buy a $30 alarm clock off of Amazon. And again, I had to break through a whole bunch of different things to get there. But that's what it is. That's what, I mean, the whole path of productivity. And again, I think what's interesting is that you talk about make time. And the reason, and I wonder, I look at this and I go, the reason it's make time is because time is measurable. Time is quantitative. People can wrap their heads around it. And productivity can mean something completely different to another person versus time.
Yeah.
Time is very, and you talk about attention and stuff too. But everyone's I just walked you through my decision-making process as to why I now have a new alarm clock where some people could go, well, that was neat. I would have, who cares? I can use my phone. I don't, like you guys had the phone experiment that you talk about at the very beginning where it's like, there, that's your solution, right? So it can be how you get there is a study and a story on your relationship with this stuff altogether, right?
Yeah. And there's a lot of different approaches to this. You know, there's a lot of advice out there. There's a lot of books that say, just do it this way.
Right.
You know, like, trust me, I tried all the things or it works for these scientific theoretical reasons and just do it this way. And, you know, sure, some people are going to read that book and they're going to be like, yeah, totally. I trust this person. I'm going to do it. Other people are like you, or they're like me or Jake. And we're going to say, we're gonna approach it as designers. We're gonna say, I've got this issue. You know, I've got this goal, and you know, me as the sort of the actor in this scenario, I'm having trouble reaching that goal. So how can I design this environment or this process or whatever to get me to that goal? And then I think there's other people who, you know, they want to experiment with this stuff and they're interested in it, but maybe they don't have the same level of awareness about the extent to which these things can be sort of hacked and tweaked and customized.
Right.
And that I think is one of the unique things that we bring to this conversation, is that since Jake and I worked in the tech industry, and since, you know, we both consider ourselves to be enthusiastic and optimistic about technology, you know, I think unlike Cal Newport, you know, we're not going to say you should use less technology.
Right.
You know, that is clear. You know, I don't know if those are the exact words, but there's a very clear message that his thesis is you should use this stuff less.
Right. And from his vantage point, as a professor who, and I mean, we've had a chance to hang out before, he's never adopted it. So for him, it's never been something he's had to distance himself from to the degree that most people are facing, which is technology. They're digital natives. They were born into it, right?
Right.
So,
and I mean, one of the things that Jake and I understand so well, having worked as designers in the tech industry, is how powerful defaults are and the ways that things are configured by default. You know, even as something as simple as you get a new phone, you take it out of the box, you turn it on, and one of the very first things you do is you sign into your email account. Mm-hmm. And then by default, of course, your phone's got an email app installed. By default, it's checking for messages in the background. By default, it's showing you notification. And it that type of thing exists times a million across all the different devices you use, across all the norms of how your workplace operates, of your daily habits, whatever. And so I think if you can start to step back and say, oh, like when I use my phone as an alarm clock, it means that that default notification that's going to be there on the screen means that I'm more likely to pick up my phone. Oh, that's interesting. So now what can I do about that? Well, I can move the phone, or I can disable that notification, or I can uninstall that app. And you start to have this new way of looking at the world around you.
Yep.
And I think, you know, another component that is a big part of this is understanding friction. And from the world of habit research, you know, there's a big conclusion, which is that one of the best ways to break a bad habit is to add friction, to actually make it more difficult to do the thing you don't want to do. And that's very much a part of this approach as well, is make it more difficult to grab the phone, to check, you know, whatever is going on there, to see those notifications be interrupted in the first place. So yeah, I think it's we've just tried to give people a bit of context and perspective around how these things are set up by default, and then what the options are for starting to redesign those defaults.
Well, and the other thing is too, is that it also puts you in a position where if something was to change, you go as like, so for example, the notification factor. If you install a new app and you forget to turn off notifications, or you just hit okay because like, okay. And I've said, okay, I've turned off all notifications for everything else, but, and I had my phone on my nightstand, except for that one app that does notify me in the middle, you know, first thing in the morning. It removes any of the possible choices I may have made along the way to like, to do that. And I think that what I love about a lot, and we're going to go through some of these points as through the book, some of the, like the idea of, let's get into some of these now, because I know I want to get into it because I think that there's so many in here that you can go through, and the ones that I think will apply mostly to what I've seen and with the people that listen to this podcast, I think these ones are going to be relatable, especially what I've talked about in the past, like the idea of groundhogging it. The idea of using, so I start my year not on New Year's Day, and then on February 2nd, which is Groundhog Day, I do like my mid-year review. So I start my year in September 1st, because that's when my kids start school. So
cool.
And then February 2nd is around the mid-year mark. So I look at it and go, okay, do I need to make any changes? Do I want the rest of this year to look like the rest, the early part of this year, et cetera?
Yeah.
So can you talk about groundhogging? Because there's a very similar tack to this.
So for just a bit of perspective, we talk about this idea of groundhogging it in the context of setting a daily highlight.
Right.
So each day, sort of asking yourself, what's the one thing that deserves my best energy and my best focus today? You know, not the only thing that you're going to do, certainly, and not even necessarily like the thing that needs to get done. But like, if I can only pay attention to one thing today, what do I want that to be? It might be something that has to happen. It might be something that you want to happen. It might be something that's just fun. And this tactic of groundhogging it really sort of is about doubling down and tripling down on that highlight and saying, okay, well, if there's something that I really need to make progress on, I'm not just going to do it one day. I'm not just going to make it my highlight for one day, but I'm going to make that my highlight every single day this week. And I am going to, I'm just going to get deep into this thing, and I'm going to sort of benefit from having all the information about it kind of loaded up in my mental RAM. And I'm just going to go deep on making progress on that one thing. So that's the idea of groundhogging.
I've been talking with John about making time. And for those of you who've been following my work for a while, you know that I'm all about crafting your time. And I wanted to share something with you that I don't share very often on this episode, but you might see it in the show notes if you're a subscriber. And that's my 30 Days of Time Crafting course. In fact, it's backed by the $5 guarantee. Now, what does that mean? Well, there's this movie, which was a novel first called The Legend of Bagger Vance, and there's a huge story behind it. But ultimately, the character played by Will Smith helped the character played by Matt Damon for just $5. He helped him find his swing. He helped him get on track. And that's what 30 Days of Time Crafting can do for you. It's a 30-day email program that also includes other valuable resources that you can use time and time again. You get access forever and ever when you sign up for just $5. So if you're interested in taking my fundamental and foundational 30 Days of Time Crafting course, all you need to do is go to productivityist.com/$5. That's the word five spelled out, then dollars. Really, it's $5 guaranteed. It's going to help you craft your time better and make more time in the process. So what are you waiting for? Visit productivityist.com/$5 today. Now let's get back to my conversation with John Suratsky here on the Productivityist podcast. Again, the highlighting portion is, you talk about, you know, obviously there's a good 16 tactics in the highlighting area, which is really great. But one of the things I want to touch on is journaling real quick. Do you journal?
Well, the answer is sort of. So the fourth step in the make time framework is reflect.
Yep.
And we think that most people ought to have a structured way of paying attention to what they're doing with their time and what they're paying attention to. And it's kind of funny because I think a lot of people are used to being analytical and critical about their work, you know, and what happens in the office. People are used to doing postmortems and retrospectives and all those things and saying, hey, well, you know, what happened with this project? Did it fail? Did it succeed? You know, who's at fault here? What happened? But when it comes to our own time, you know, this finite, precious resource that we have, we don't often look back and say, what did I really do today? What did I really spend my time on? And so we encourage people to take just a couple of minutes and answer some questions in this template that we provide in the book to help you reflect on what's working so that you can make tweaks and hopefully make tomorrow a little bit better. And so I do that every day, but I wouldn't really consider it a journal because it's really more of a templatized, you know, it's like, it's almost like a survey. It's like it's like you're running a little experiment, but you're the only participant, you know, it's like a clinical trial with an N of one. And so you're sort of answering these questions, but the extended part of the answer is that my wife and I have recently started writing a short shared journal together. And so I'm dipping a toe into the journaling waters. And that's been really fun, but generally I have found it very difficult to form a habit around journaling. I think in part because I don't see the, I generally don't see the short-term benefits to doing it. So I don't have that reward, you know, to kind of keep that habit loop going. Whereas with the reflect, the notes that we encourage people to do as part of Make Time, there is a short-term benefit of making tweaks to the tactics you're going to use and hopefully being able to spend your time on the things you care about a little bit more tomorrow than you did today.
Interesting, because when I read that part of the book, I'm like, oh, he journals. Because that to me is journaling. Like, I mean, I know it's a survey. Yeah. I know it's interesting that words matter and distinction of, because I mean, I think that, you know, we talked about like simple versus ease, right? And simple versus easy, which by the way, ease and easy are also different. But I think the idea of, because it's a survey, technically you're doing a scientific study on yourself it's the story of your day, right?
Yeah.
Right. And that is, I mean, again, if you look at the definition of journaling, a journal is a sort of story, right? It's a chronicle. So what's interesting is that, I think that whatever it takes for that reflection to happen and whatever that needs to be, I think is, so if you're, as someone who's listening to this, if you're like, oh no, I like the idea of reflection. It's way better than journaling. That's great because you're still doing that. And it's highly undervalued and underutilized to do that, to take that. We often are so focused on moving forward that we don't take a chance to reflect and go, okay, are we moving in the right direction? Like, was it worth it? Time craters. This is in the laser section, which we'll talk about the idea of focusing. And what is the time crater that you still struggle with? I want people to read the book and we'll, you know, maybe you can define what a time crater is first, just to give some context. But what's the one that you still find yourself, as you reflect on a day, going, oh man, that time crater got me again?
Yeah. So a time crater is anything that you choose to do where the sort of initial action or the initial choice is quite small, but then it ends up having this much bigger kind of outsized effect on your time or your attention or your energy levels. And so the one for me that I probably continue to struggle with the most is LinkedIn, actually. It used to be Twitter. And as I've kind of shifted my focus more toward LinkedIn, I find that, you know, what begins in my mind as a very simple idea, you know, like, oh, I'm going to post this thing on LinkedIn. You know, I've got this video from a talk that I gave. I'm going to post it. It's going to take me 10 minutes. It's going to be great. You know, people are going to find it. They're going to see it. Then they're going to want to contact me. It's going to be wonderful. I find that what happens is instead of 10 minutes, actually getting that post ready and that video ready, it takes half an hour or an hour. And then I don't just post it and then forget about it, you know, because a couple hours later, I'm like, oh, I wonder if anybody responded. Like, I wonder, what are the reactions to this? Is anybody posting any interesting comments? Did anybody reshare it? And so I find myself being drawn back into LinkedIn again and again. So that's one, you know, it doesn't have a huge effect on my life. And, you know, through a lot of the tactics that we share in the book and a lot of things that you and I have already talked about, I have ways of kind of limiting my access to LinkedIn so that it doesn't take over my day. But that's just one example. And, you know, so if I think about all the other things that do or could be time craters in my life, you could pretty quickly start to see how a relatively small number of small decisions or actions could actually end up taking a huge amount of your energy and time throughout the day.
Yeah, for me that was auditing one password yesterday.
Yeah, I think email is another a sort of a time crater, because you know, you think oh, I'm going to just do a quick check of email. I've got 15 minutes before my next meeting. I'm going to just jump in there and respond to a couple messages. But you know, even if you do have a hard stop and you say, well, I'm going to close email now because I've got a meeting, there's this attention residue that builds up. And I learned about that concept from Cal Newport.
Yep.
But it's a sort of a relatively well understood concept in cognitive research, that when we pay attention to something, but we don't sort of close the loop, we don't finish whatever that thing was, it kind of hangs around in our brains for a while. And so if you're constantly exposing yourself to these quick little email checks, you know, each one of those things, each one of those sessions is pretty small, but the crater, the impact that it has on your time and your attention throughout the day is pretty massive.
And that's why, like, if you can go into email with some kind of filtration in place, like knowing, okay, I'm going to go check this area as opposed to just the giant, overwhelming, monolithic inbox, that can be helpful. But yeah, I mean, attention residue is, I mean, David Allen talks about that in Closing Loops and Getting Things Done, right? Last question about the different areas. The one I want to focus on now is the energize. I first read about the caffeine nap and from Austin Kleon. I'll link to it in the show notes about the idea of taking a nap, the idea of a caffeine nap that he brought up. Can you talk about that? As somebody who, I'm not going to say what you are because then it'll give away. You have to go back and look whether you're a morning or night person. But are caffeine naps something that you utilize and is something you experiment with, or is it more something that you've discovered and say, hey, this is a good, tactic to try? Especially when you're working at Google, didn't they have the pods and stuff that you could go nap in if you really wanted to?
Yeah. So I will admit I've never taken a nap at the office. So in all those years I worked at Google and all those nap pods, I never actually took a nap at Google. I would say that I take, let me say this. I probably take a nap like every couple of weeks and pretty much all of those naps are caffeine naps. So Basically, if I'm going to take a nap, it's usually in the early afternoon. So it's usually like right after lunch when, maybe I got up early and I'm tired, maybe it's, whatever, had a big lunch, a heavy lunch. Maybe I've got something later in the day I want to have good energy for. I'll take a nap. It'll be right after lunch. But I pretty much always pair it with caffeine, meaning that I will drink some coffee or some tea right before I go to sleep. And then I know that it's going to take a while for that caffeine to circulate through my bloodstream and reach my brain. And I know that it's that when I wake up, I'm going to feel amazing because I will have cleared away the adenosine that was causing to me be groggy. And then at the same time, that caffeine is going to sort of bind and kick in. So not only will I be rested from that nap, but I'll have the additional energy boost of caffeine. So yeah, that is definitely something I still use. And in fact, I would say that I probably use all of the tactics in the book to some extent. And there's a bunch of them. There's 87. Right. Yeah. And there's a bunch of tactics that are not in the book. We have, depending on how you count at any given point in time, probably 15 to 20 bonus tactics that we share in various places. It's not like I do all of them all the time, but we didn't really put anything in the book that was like, oh, that's interesting. You might give it a shot. We wanted to have like a slightly higher bar of like, yeah, we've tried this and it works for us and it works for other people. And the science is there and the research is there. I pretty much do all this stuff, from time to time.
Last question before we wrap up, because I can go back in the days of the early days of the apps. What's the first productivity to-do list app that you used?
Gosh, that's a great question.
Because I don't normally ask about apps because there's a ton. But since we're going back into the way back machine, probably an app that doesn't exist anymore. Is there one that you remember?
Oh, like, man. I'll tell you two interesting stories about this.
Sure.
One is that there was an app, and I actually wrote about it in the book, but I'm blanking on the name. Oh, Mori, which was an app created by, do you know this? Mori?
I remember it's sparking something in me. So it must be there. Yeah. Yeah. I remember hearing about it. I remember. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. And it was this amazing app that was sort of this, it's actually kind of being reincarnated with like Notion and Coda now, but it was this, sort of like infinitely extensible and customizable note-taking app.
Right.
And I went through this period where I got like so obsessed with using it that I basically spent like weeks getting my whole life in it.
It was like notational velocity and stuff before it actually, like, I think there was a lot of like, what was the Simple Note and all those ones? They were kind of like this where you could modify it. Yeah. Those ones. Yeah.
That's right. I also used Simple Note for a time, but then, of course, a couple of years later, like the app was no longer supported. It was like being discontinued.
And there were no mobile versions either. So it's like
before the iPhone. Yep. came out. So that was one. But then the other interesting anecdote, at least I think it's interesting, is that I actually designed and built my own custom to-do list app with a friend of mine. One of my best friends is a software developer, and we built an app called Dunzo.
I remember. Was it D-U-N? Zero.
No, it wasn't. No, it was one of the many problems with it was the brand. It was spelled D-O-N-E-Z-O. So everybody thought it was Donizo. But it was it started as a web app.
Uh-huh.
And it was a very GTD influence, you know, with just the sort of the structure of the list was very much GTD influenced. Right. And then we actually our iPhone app for Dunzo was one of the very first iPhone apps that would sync over the air, so over the cellular network between your phone and your computer, because it was a web app, and then it was the app itself, the app on the phone would sync over the cellular network in like a really lightweight way, and these things would stay connected, and you didn't have to plug into your phone or be on Wi-Fi and do like click a button to sync. So that was kind of
cool. How SimpleNote did it with Simperium, I think. It was a connective.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was one of those. I was thinking you might have gone Kinkless GTD or IGTD.
No.
Because Kinkless was the one Merlin kept touting back in the day.
Yeah. No, I don't think I used either of those.
And then IGTD went on to be acquired by Cultured Code.
Feel like all these apps I installed and opened
like Thinking like, at least like once. Thinking Rock and all those ones. And I mean, Matt Diavella still uses To-Do, like T-E-U-X-D-E-U-X, which is still around.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in Swiss Miss, who's Swiss Miss again? Tina Roth Eisenberg.
Yes.
It's one of those things where those apps have been around forever. And remember when mobile apps people weren't as hung up on mobile components of it. It was just like, hey, I'm going on my desktop. I'm going to use these apps. And that's where like those apps kind of live.
That's where this kind of work happens.
Yep. Yep. So anyway, I don't normally talk about apps on the show, but I figured you had some rich history with it. Hey, John, this has been great. Thanks for sticking around a little bit longer. We could have kept going for sure.
No kidding.
Make Time, How to Focus on What Matters Every Day by Jake Knapp and John Zaraski. John, where can people pick up the book and keep up with your work, as I will be doing it, and I have done, but I'll be doing it even more so now that we've had a chance to really dig into the geekdom of time management and productivity.
Yeah, well, the book is everywhere. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble, et cetera, your local library even. But best place to kind of dig deep and get started with this stuff is maketime.blog. That's our website. That's where we've got articles, resources, tools, training, our online courses there, a bunch of stuff. So maketime.blog.
John, thanks so much for joining me today on the Productivityist Podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.